League's Cup returns to Columbus. Your reigning League's Cup champion Columbus Crew are hosting three matches at Lower.com Field. Come out and watch the Crew take on teams from Liga MX, Toluca, Puebla, and León starting July 29th. Grab your tickets now at ColumbusCrew.com and watch the best in North America battle to keep the trophy at home in Columbus. No ties, only wins. Major League Soccer versus Liga MX. League's Cup returns to Columbus, Ohio. Be there.
This podcast is sponsored by IQBar. Your favorite clean, functional, delicious nutrition brand is raising the bar with a little help from Thomas Keller, Michelin star chef of the French Laundry. IQBar and Thomas Keller have teamed up to create a salted caramel chip protein bar and yuzu mango hydration mix. With toasted macadamia nuts, rich caramel flavor, and brain-boosting nutrients, this bar is like having a Michelin star meal in your pocket. Pair it with the taste bud tingling yuzu mango IQ mix hydration mix, packed with magnesium and adaptogens to improve clarity and mood. With Keller's culinary excellence and IQ Bar's commitment to great taste and clean ingredients, this limited edition collaboration is simply mwah. And the best part is that 10% of sales go directly to Chef Keller's nonprofit, Mentor, that supports aspiring young chefs. Great taste, great nutrition, great mission. Go to IQBar.com today and enter promo code KELLER20 to get 20% off all IQ Bar products plus free shipping. That's IQBAR.com, promo code KELLER20.
Hang in there, it is.
That's Smiley Kaufman for 61. Wow.
I'm Smiley Kaufman, and this is The Smiley Show.
What's up, y'all?
What a crazy week in the world of golf with this stunning announcement that the PGA Tour and LIV Golf will be unifying. If you need to get caught up on that, go to the feed right now and download our emergency pod reacting to the news. I am pumped to bring you this next conversation as we will be talking to a tour pro who is in the room for the players meeting with Jay Monahan at the RBC Canadian Open. We also went in depth on his golf journey, and I couldn't let him go without nerding out on the golf swing. So without further ado, here's my chat with Michael Kim. All right, guys, we have Michael Kim joining us. He was on site at the RBC Canadian Open today. Michael, where were you when you found out about this merger between the PGA Tour and I don't even know what yet? Where were you when you found out the news?
I was playing a practice round on the front nine. I was on the fourth hole tee box. I was playing with Andrew Novak and just randomly saw an email from the PGA Tour with like a commissioner's note. And kind of one of those I thought where it was just like a like John Deere emailed us. Or they
that was when we got last week.
For 2 years. Yeah. I was like, I thought it was just kind of a throwaway email. Just kind of opened it. And at first I was like, what am I reading? Like, what am I even reading? And I was kind of reading it out loud. And Andrew's like about to hit his tee shot. He goes, hey, I think it says LIV and PGA is merging. He's like, huh? And he just kind of hits. And I was like, and I just kind of kept reading the email. And I was just in shock. And I was like, no, literally, like, it says all the litigations are going to go away. Like, you know, it looks like it's going to be a big deal with the Saudi money and the PGA Tour. And after that, obviously, where do you go? You go to Twitter and, you know, things start flying, like CNBC is reporting it. Jay and what's the Saudi guy's name, who's apparently going to be a chairman, I guess. But
I'm not sure. I got to really touch up on all of my Saudi guys' names now.
Me too. I was just on that fourth tee box. I was kind of in shock, honestly. And I was pretty distracted for the entire front nine. So we'll see.
Yeah. Like, did you get any work done the rest of that front nine in that practice round, or were you just like in shock talking about it the entire time?
It was kind of like, all right, when I was hitting each shot, like I was trying to focus, and then like the entire way, like walk up to the golf ball, I'm just, you know, looking like reactions, like, you know, and then between the players, like, all right, who do you think knew about this? You know, did Tiger even know about this? Did Rory even know about this? You know, just all that talk between the players and caddies was kind of crazy.
I mean, you kind of nailed it on Twitter though, talking about, well, when you got your tee time announcement of what time you were playing, you said, well, I'm a little surprised I'm not going to be teeing off on 12A. That was A plus Twitter work. I mean, what was your initial reaction when you saw it though? I mean, you kind of touched on it there a little bit, but I mean, would you was it more confusion, or did you kind of have a general idea of what it meant?
I think it was honestly more confusion, because it was more like, are we joining with Liv? Are we, because a lot of the headlines, it showed merger. And so I was like, what does that mean? Was that, are we getting bought out? I mean, is Liv and PGA Tour going to be like one big tour? Just, you know, a lot of different questions. And, you know, the player meeting kind of gave some answers, but at the same time, you know, I think Jay was purposely being a little vague at times just to not kind of trap himself into a box, you know, of what he said. And so, you know, to be honest, I'm still like trying to see what's going on, and, you know, only time will tell, I guess.
Yeah. Well, you finished the nine holes, and I assume you went immediately to talk to players, whether that be at lunch, and then you talked to players in the meeting. Was that kind of the general consensus from everybody you talked to, was just like, what in the world is going on? Or did anybody like come out and say, oh, wait, this is what's going on?
Everyone was just confused. Everyone was on, you know, social media. Even like the PGA Tour staff was kind of like, don't look at us. Like, the player meeting's at 4 p.m. Jay is going to be there. Andy Bassler's going to be there. You know, and I think everyone knew that nothing like too much was going to come out before that meeting. And everyone was just waiting, practicing, kind of going back to their routines, and just waiting for that meeting to start.
So the meeting starts, and I saw like a little clip that Wesley Bryant put. So I did kind of see what the layout looked like. That podium looked very far away from everybody, almost scary far away. So what was, when Jay walked into the room, was like, could you hear like a pin drop? Is that kind of what the vibe was right at the get go?
I was like 10 minutes late, unfortunately, to the meeting.
Oh, you missed like the best part, I think.
Toronto traffic was a lot worse than I thought. And Jay had kind of gone through some of his, you know, talking points here and there. And then I was able to sit for most of the meeting. I don't think he talked a whole lot in the beginning. He just kind of opened up to Q&A pretty quickly. You know, obviously, some players felt betrayed, I guess. They were just, I think we're all in shock. And there was a lot of like, you kind of told us this from the beginning a year ago, and now it's all of a sudden like, you know, complete 180, like, you know, what's going on? And certain players literally asked like, how much, you know, what's the number? And Jay was pretty, you know, strong on like, look, guys, it's just a framework deal. We're going to hammer out the details, but this is what I think is good for the tour and all that. But, you know, guys were a lot. There is, you know, a decent amount of tension in the room for sure.
We all have more questions than answers, you know, coming, you know, into the day, in the middle of the day, coming out of the day. I'm sure you went to that meeting with a lot of questions. I'm just curious, of the questions you had, how many of those got answered, and what additional questions you came out of that meeting with that did not get answered?
Well, you know, right off the bat, I was just wondering, all right, so how much is it? Well, I think my first question was, is it a merge? Who's in charge? Is Jay going to be in charge? Is the guys from PIF and Saudi going to be in charge? And Jay kind of over and over hammered the point that, you know, the PGA Tour and Jay is still in charge of where the money goes, how much money might potentially be brought in, where the money goes. And because he was being vague, and I don't blame him for being vague, like, you know, obviously the details literally haven't been hammered out yet. But because the details are vague, it's like, you know, there's no real like numbers to any of this. It's just that I think the tour realized like these designated events are great, and this new next season coming up is great as well. But at the same time, I think the tour kind of came to a conclusion that it's not exactly sustainable. The tour has gone through a lot of their reserves for this season and next season. I mean, he's not stupid. He obviously knows what a big like media hit this was going to be, and how negatively this was going to make the tour look. But I think he kind of realized, look, we can get a huge influx of cash brought in and kind of remove the live threat that that we all saw. And so it's kind of a, you know, you take some, you lose some kind of approach, it seemed like.
Yeah, the sustainable model that you refer to, we talked about earlier, and I think you're exactly right. I think that's what kind of led to this. They're like, we can't continue to battle LiveTour in this because eventually we're just going to run out of money. And Jay was, he was pretty adamant about that the entire time, that we could not get in a money battle with the Saudis. And so we ended up here. But I'm also curious, in this room, there's been rumors that Cameron Percy tweeted out something about that Maverick McNealy is so smart. And was he like one of the best question askers in that meeting, or like who were the MVPs in there? I'm kind of curious from a player perspective.
Well, you know, it depends on what you ask from your most valuable player.
Yeah. Which,
if you just want some like just shots, I'm just going to take shots left and right. Grayson Murray was definitely the top dog. If you wanted like the veteran in the room, Ben Crane was up there. Brent Snedeker was up there.
Ooh, Sneds is I've been in a meeting with Sneds where he's been.
He's firing.
Yeah, he's. I bet he was pretty aggressive in that entire meeting.
I assume you were in that meeting at Torrey Pines.
Yes.
Like one of our rookie years when he was like, you know, went off at the USGA kind of thing. But yeah, he was going after it. You know, Maverick, he's like very quiet. Obviously, he's super smart. And so like he would ask certain questions, but obviously very pointed and smart questions. But it was one of those where like I was kind of on the other side of the room and I can kind of, I had to like really pay attention to like what he was asking. You know, there were just questions that Jay didn't have answers to at the moment. And so, you know, it was great questions, but at the same time, like there were probably questions that Jay either chose not to answer, but more than likely, like he just couldn't answer because he just didn't have the details.
In what context did Rory have to comment to tell Grayson play better? Because that came out. I'm curious how, in what way did we end up with Rory being like, dude, just play better. And I love Grayson to death and he is playing better. So I'm curious how we ended up there.
I think Grayson was trying to make a point that like, you know, guys gave up a lot of money to stay with the PGA Tour. Not him, obviously, but guys like Rory.
Yeah.
And at the same time, he had been making a lot of comments about like Jay should resign and all that, and pretty like blatantly saying to everybody like you should not be the commissioner anymore. And I think it was something along the lines of like, Rory, like, did you give up like, you know, a ton of money to stay on the PGA Tour? And Rory was like, I'm quite happy with where I'm at. And Grayson was like, oh, of course you are. Like, of course you are. And like, it was kind of a little back and forth. And then Rory kind of hit up the play better, Grayson. Honestly, it didn't go that well in the room because, like, obviously he gets to kind of say that. But yeah, it's not exactly what we're here for. Like, honestly, like if in this whole scenario, the one that's lost the most is probably Rory because he could have signed for the most amount of money to live if he wanted to, you know, at any point during the last year. So I was really curious of what he thought. I left a little early, I guess, because I think he spent a lot more time talking to other players at the end after Jay was done. So I wasn't able to catch that. But, you know, it's just things are moving pretty fast, I guess.
Were you surprised by Rory's demeanor, given what you just kind of laid out? Because that's something we talked about earlier, is that he seems like he's one of the guys who has not only given up the most financially, but in the way he's gone out in front of the media in this past year and kind of really stood up for the tour in a lot of different ways. And it seems like that's had an impact on his golf as well. Did that surprise you at all that he, you know, said, I'm happy with where I'm at?
I think he knew the effect that his comments could possibly have. And to be honest, I think most pros assume that he knew about the whole process, because, you know, he's the face of the PGA Tour at the moment. And so I assume that he would have had knowledge of all these few meetings, but, you know, that was not the case. And I think he knew whatever he said could have a lot of impact in the media and in the meeting. So at least during the meeting, he was trying to just kind of take it all in. And he was kind of careful to not give just knee-jerk reactions, because, you know, his words have real sway in the player meeting. He's part of the board and the face of the tour. So I think he was trying to just take it in, let it kind of play out, and just kind of be pretty careful with his words.
Yeah, I had actually heard that Rory was the only player that was told, and he was told at 7 a.m. this morning. So that we're talking just as early as 7 in the morning was the only player that was told. So
yeah.
The one question that I would have probably asked Jay if I would have been in the room, and I'm curious if anybody else asked this question, did anybody ask Jay if or why that he didn't take the stand more for the guys? I just felt like Rory, JT, Max kind of had to stand up there and answer all of these LIV Golf questions for, it felt like, the entire golf season last year. And obviously Rory played well and JT won a major. Max had a great year, but still, I feel like that's the responsibility of the commissioner to answer those questions for us, so where we can just focus on playing golf. Did anybody kind of ask Jay, like, why didn't you stand up for this the entire time, so where we felt like you were a part of this process?
Yeah, you know, no one really asked that question. I think, you know, it's tough because the PGA Tour has so many members, and it's really hard to be like completely unified. And at the end of the day, like, going to live or not is like kind of a personal choice at the end of the day. And so I think it's much easier to, or Rory, not, maybe not easy, but, you know, whether Rory decides not to go, like, he can say what he thinks about certain decisions that he's made, and same goes for every tour player. But, you know, Jay's comments for the tour in whole, I don't know what he could say. I mean, there's a lawsuit going on. I just don't know how much he would have been able to say. I mean, sure, like, looking back, I'm sure Rory would have loved for Jay to answer some of the tougher questions that Rory constantly getting asked. But, you know, it's a tour that's made up of 200 plus members, and it's just tough to talk about the whole thing.
Was there much of a promise made from Jay that was in regards to financials, and the fact that, like, hey, you guys are going to all make a lot more money in this? Like, was anything like that brought up?
Like I said, like, someone literally.
I hate to keep on asking, like, same questions, you know?
Number? Yeah. and, you know, honestly, that's honestly a question that we obviously had. But he kind of pointed out, like, you know, we've been strapped by, like, the nonprofit organization model that the tour had. This allows us to get to a for-profit model, and PIF, the Saudis are just going to be an investor in that model. And it almost seemed like he was even careful, just saying, he kept saying, it's going to be in the billions, guys. But even that, he was pretty monotone and was very careful not to list too many details.
As you've laid out numerous times, it's tough to know what all this means right now. But just based on what you know, and based on what you can kind of guess or ascertain, you know, what do you see as right now your biggest concerns about this merger, and what the biggest potential upside might be?
Well, the upside, honestly, is pretty easy. There's a ton of cash coming in from the Saudis. And I think, and that should lead to more money for the players. That's an easy upside. But at the same time, I think my concern is, how quickly do all these decisions get made? And I think a lot of the players are wondering whether the live players that have left can come back. And if they do come back, I doubt that it's just going to be an open door policy. Like, are there going to be punishments? Are there going to be fines? All these things everyone was asking, but they haven't been decided on. And how quickly can we transfer to the profit as a for-profit company? And how quickly will that money kind of feed back to the players? All these questions obviously can't be answered. But those were my primary concerns was, how quickly can we get all these decisions made? How quickly can the money kind of drip back to the players into the purses or however they want to invest the money? So it's just obviously for me, the quicker the better, but we'll see.
It kind of almost makes you forget about what we debated kind of for this entire year talking about the USGA rollback. I think everybody has completely forgot about the golf ball. Now we're like, We don't care about the golf ball. We have got to figure out what is going on in our big house, and nobody knows what door and who's opening what door and who's running that house. But so Michael, you're at the RBC Canadian Open. We already know that. But there is going to be a golf tournament played, and you've had there is going to be a golf tournament played, and you've had a career resurgence, man. And I've been watching from the sidelines, cheering you on. I went through something similar to what you went through kind of around the exact same time. Really, we both were playing bad golf and missing cuts and seeing each other on Monday practicing on the range, man. It was a grind, but I just want to hear what got you over the hump and really how you were able to stay positive during really tough times.
I've had a lot of time to reflect on it because the down years were so long. Because it honestly started like late 2018 and continued to like 2021 after 2021. So, I have to give a ton of credit to Sean Foley, who I started seeing at the end of 2021. And funny enough, he was like one of the last few guys I called because I kind of had these preconceived notions of like what he would teach because of the stuff he did with Tiger back in the day, Hunter Mahan. And I just didn't think it was going to work out, even though I had known Sean since 2013, even before I turned pro. Probably we started working in late August, and I think I had a lesson with him, probably my third or fourth lesson, where it felt a little different than a lot of the stuff that I was working on prior. It made sense in my head. I felt like I could do what he was trying to tell me to do, and I just had to make sure I could do it in tournaments, because like it's the most frustrating thing in the world was when you can do it on the range, you can do it at your home course, but as soon as the lights come on, you have no idea where the ball is going. And so, I started off a little slow on the Korn Ferry Tour last year. But then the third week, Panama. Did you ever play Panama?
Oh, yeah. I think it's kind of the rite of passage for any professional golfer. They have to play in Panama to know what the firmest golf course they'll ever play is.
100%. And Panama is like, typically Korn Ferry courses are much easier than PGA Tour courses, but Panama is a pretty tough golf course.
Hot and windy.
I had a really good week ball striking wise there. And I think that's when I knew like truly that I was on the right steps to where I wanted to go. And to answer your second question, of like how I stayed positive. I mean, like you go through so many ups and downs, right? You like golf is so crazy in that like you'll play around for like 16 holes where like nothing's working. And then like, okay, on the 17th hole, you like try something different. And like, oh my gosh, it's like, I think that's a little bit better. And it gives you like a glimmer of hope. But, you know, like what helped me kind of stay on point was and stay positive was like, I knew like my peak golf was there. Like I won my one tournament that I won by 8 shots. And, you know, I beat Francesco Molinari, who was in second place that won the British Open the next week. And so, you know, I just knew I needed to raise my floor a lot, but I knew the peak was there. And honestly, I had PGA Tour status for a while because of COVID extended it a year. And so, you know, I was never going to give up PGA Tour status just because I was struggling. And so I just kept trying. And luckily, I was able to see Sean before it was too late.
Did you draw any inspiration from Max?
100%. You know, Max kind of went through his struggles, obviously. But not only Max, like Brendan Todd. I thought Brendan, listening to a lot of his interviews and what he had gone through, and I talked to him right after he had won twice, like two, was it 2 weeks in a row almost?
He won it. It was in the fall. It was he was on a run that was insane. I remember that.
I remember it was maybe not 2 weeks in a row, but it was really close to each other. And so I called him, you know, to ask like how he had gone through and what he had done to get out of his rut, because I thought a lot of what he went through was very similar to what I was going through. So, you know, guys like Max, guys like Brendan, and kind of gives you hope that, like, you know, you can kind of do what they did.
Yeah. And Brendan Todd, he went back to back, winning in Bermuda and Mayakoba. He actually almost won the following week at the RSM. It was almost a three-peat. I do remember
that
was in the cards heading into Sunday. It just kind of ran out of gas. But man, it's tough because it's hard to verbalize kind of what you're going through because you experience all these different emotions you've never really felt on a golf course. You know, we've for most of our careers, we're, you know, you're positive, you have fun out there, but you've never had scar tissue that you've had to deal with because you're making swing changes and you see balls take off in areas that you've never hit a golf ball. And it's so difficult when you step on a tee box, knowing where you could potentially hit a golf ball. 100%. What did you do from a routine standpoint to almost start tricking your brain to not worry about outcomes and just be able to focus on the shot in front of you? Because I feel like that's one of the most difficult things to do when you're coming out of a rut.
Interestingly enough, when I was doing better with Sean, and I was seeing the ball kind of in a much tighter dispersion pattern, I was still dealing with a lot of anxiety on the golf course. And it's like, you know, a lot of times it feels like a ticking time bomb on the golf course where, like, even if you hit your first three or four golf shots really well, like exactly the way you want to, you're like, it's always in the back of your mind. Like, okay, when's it coming? And I realized just honestly, like in Mexico this year at Vedanta, Sean gave me a book to read only because, he wanted me to read the book, but at the same time, I actually hurt my back Tuesday morning. So I was literally doing nothing but just icing my back. And John gave me a book to read. It's called Golf Beneath the Surface by a guy named Raymond Pryor. And I had kind of realized that I was still, even though I was playing way better than before, I was still dealing with a decent amount of anxiety on the golf course. And I realized that I was still, my big miss was to the right, as I think a lot of guys do tend to do with their drivers. I was still trying to make sure I wasn't missing it right. Like, as long as I didn't miss it way right, it was almost a success to me. And that's, you're just trying to survive. And that mentality still brings anxiety, and that's still a derivative of fear. And I realized that, you know, first you need to try your best to stay in the present. Because once you're in the future, it's all the what ifs. Like, what if the ball goes way right? What if the ball goes way left? What if my swing does this? You know, all those lead to anxiety. And so if you're in the present, you can just literally try to focus the shot at hand. And the last thing is acceptance. Like, wherever the ball goes, I'm going to accept it. I'm going to move on. I'm just going to go try to hit the next one. And so, you know, my motto kind of starting that week was, I'm going to try and not survive. I'm going to try and thrive. I'm going to try to hit the shot that I want. And whatever happens after that, I'm going to accept. I'm going to move on. And I felt a lot better the first 2 days. And to be honest, it was actually a good, maybe not a good thing, but because I had hurt my back, I was kind of unsure whether or not I was going to play. So I kind of had the mentality of like, I just want to see how my back feels. I'm just going to hit a few soft ones and kind of see what happens. And if I play well, great. If I don't, you know, I can rest my back. And so I kind of had a bit of a head start in that. Yeah, you know, I played pretty well the first two rounds, and I actually got paired with John Rahm the third round. And I think if I hadn't read that book beforehand, I think I would have struggled a lot more than I did. I felt really comfortable out there with John, you know, just trying to stay in the present, which is like not too hard, honestly. If you put your task to it, it's paying attention to like all the feelings that you're going through in your body. Just try to, you know, listen to the birds or the sounds that you hear. Just mindfulness tricks here and there. And yeah, ever since then, I feel like I've been in a better spot mentally as well.
Oddly enough, I was on your group that day with John Rahm. And so I got to watch you play a good amount of golf that day, and you did play great. I didn't sense any just nervousness. You looked great out there. You're walking tall. You looked comfortable playing with John Rahm. And I'm curious, I would assume this, that playing with him and seeing it live and realizing, okay, this has been one of the top players in the world, and you see it live, you're okay, he does some really good stuff, but so do I. And you end up finishing around like 30th that week, is that about right? But heading to the next week, you carried over some confidence from maybe playing with John Rahm on that Saturday, and you finished 7th at Wells Fargo, and then you finished T6 at the Schwab.
Yeah, definitely. You know, there's a certain level of nervousness and pressure you feel when you play with a guy like John Rahm, a top player. And that was, I'm pretty sure that was his start right after he won the Masters. And so there's a bit of like nervousness, there's some nerves, like in that first tee shot, it's like literally, like you can't imagine a worse tee shot for me to start off.
Oh my God, that first tee shot is a nightmare. I got on that tee and I said, oh boy, would I be trying to save that one from the top.
100%. It's a big dogleg right. There's water all the way up the right. Like if it starts going right and right, you're just re-teeing.
You know, what a nightmare if you have to re-tee on the tee on the first hole with John Rahm crowd, you know?
100%. Yeah, everyone's super excited that he's there. There's a, you know, we're obviously have the biggest group, biggest crowd. And so, you know, but I kind of stayed true to what I was trying to do, stay present, stay mindful, just accept it wherever it goes. And that was kind of a great little test for me, kind of able to get into the rhythm of the round a lot quicker. And when Wells Fargo came about and I was playing well, I was able to use those kind of same stuff. And also Sunday, you know, you play with a friend like Max Homa, a close friend, like that makes it a lot easier as well.
Right. And just to kind of put a bow on all of this, I want to ask you one question about your work with Sean Foley. What y'all figured out in your golf swing that was the thing that you're like, oh, yep, that's it. This works.
I think it all starts with, I think leading up to that, I don't know a better way to say this, but I was trying to like theory craft my golf swing. I was messing around with a lot of bowed left wrist, stronger club face, because if you're missing it right, the kind of the easiest, the shortest, quickest answer you get to is I'm just going to close the club face. And, you know, when you see guys like Victor Hovland, Dustin Johnson with all these bowed left wrist, and they hit the piss out of their drivers. And it's just like, wow, like I just wish I had that freedom. And it's just so easy to get caught up in like what other guys do. Sean helped me realize that, like, you know, I grew up playing with a pretty open face with a lot of hand rotation, a lot of club face rotation. And actually, in the beginning, Sean kind of told me, like, let's try to close the club face a little bit. But what was different was, you know, I want you hitting big draws, even with the closed club face, to really get that release going. And so, but then we, like a month in, we realized, like, oh no, you'd actually do way better with a neutral club face. And that's also one of the things I love about Sean, is that there's no like strict process. It's like, these are kind of your fundamentals. And as long as those fundamentals are in place, we can work a couple different options off of that. And so for me, it was kind of going back to that neutral club face. And from there, we're trying to give myself as much time as possible from the top to the ball to release it as freely as I want. So, which means not a whole lot of wrist cock, because that's wrist cock, and that just adds a lot of angles. And it just, that's basically an opener when you have a lot of wrist cock and you add more, because you have lag and hand speed, it's basically an opener. And so he goes, you know, neutral club face, but we're going to give you a really good weight shift to your right side. Again, buy me some time, give you a ton of width so that you don't have to
time it up and force
that width at the end. So, you know, really big thing for me was really getting the backswing really wide with a ton of weight transfer. Feels like you have a ton of weight transfer, but it doesn't do a whole lot. And just give myself as much time to release it beforehand, before I get to the ball. So at impact, I can kind of just keep it going without too much worry. And to this day, like ever since that kind of November lesson, we've been just hammering on the same, like few things, same fundamentals, which has been, you know, like so much better than just trying to, like, all right, let's just kind of throw and see what sticks at the wall. Like,
yes.
I'm sure you've been there. Like, everyone's been there. Like, you show up, you know, Thursday morning before your tea time, like, all right, like, what am I going to try today? It's just such a terrible spot to be in. But now I get to the golf course, I get to the range every single day. I know exactly like what I need to work on and what I am going to work on.
That's a fun place to be in that stage of life. And I lived pretty much all of that with you, all of the things you were talking about with your golf swing. You know, I went through every single bit of that, the closed club face, the bowed wrist, and then like you lose every sense of feel and how to hit an iron shot because you don't know how to hit a number. And that's what I went through going through that change. And then all of the stuff you're talking about with giving yourself more time. I've actually had some time to spend some time around Sean and David Woods and that Pro Center device. And to me, that's helped me. And I was like, how do you guys use it? Like, well, you got to get some width in it. And I'm actually starting to play better because I've been talking to Sean and David and they've been giving me some great advice. And we kind of come from that open club face tree that we are much better golfers from more of neutral than we are from closed. And God bless those guys that have closed club faces, but I can't do it.
Yeah. I mean, if I could show you the amount of like, you know, the screen recording feature on your iPhone, like
every time
like Victor Hovland was hitting, I was like, oh, I got to record. Like,
oh,
this
me
way.
Too. God, it's a blessing and a curse. Watching Victor Hovland hit a golf ball. So you're like, ooh, you know what? If I can just get that thing up and look at that thing. Look how shallow that thing. I mean, that face is, he could just go at it as hard as he wants with his right shoulder and it's never going to get offline. And then you go out there and try it and you literally have zero feel. It's a mess.
I think you realize like, you know, you can tweak the club face a little bit. When it's as drastic as you can make it with the bowed left wrist, you just lose all club face awareness. And at the end of the day, like that's like the holy grail of like knowing where your club is by kind of right before impact. And when you get that shot, it's like part of the problem is it's like super nerdy golf stuff, but like part of the problem is like you get that bowed left wrist, but because like I'm still afraid of hitting it right, I still sometimes release it and then you just get the biggest like hook you've ever seen. And then you're like, oh, that didn't work. Maybe I should like hold it off more. And then you still get the high yaw right. So it's just a terrible space to be in. But I'm glad
you're passive. Yeah. I'm sorry we had to bring up some of this stuff, but all of it, I think is you have an amazing story that you're able to tell. You're able to get and beat this game of golf and come out on the other side of this. You're playing some incredible golf, and I've had my eye on how well you've been playing for really since you started turning it around on the Korn Ferry Tour. I was like, this guy's really starting to find it, and here you go. And you're having a great year, and the Canadian Open this week, I'm flying up and I'm hoping to have your group and call some more golf of yours, and hopefully even find yourself at the top of the leaderboard at the end of the week. This would be a wild week to win, by the way.
Yeah, I think poor RBC, man. I don't know if it's good or bad. I mean, it can't be great that
no.
It seems like every year it's just always, it's been about live, and all that. But a great winner is going to come out this week as it always does every PGA Tour event. So hoping I am that guy. But
yeah, we'll be cheering you on. And I tweeted this out the other day. I think you're a tremendous follow on Twitter. And you kind of keep it real. You golf nerd it up, which I like. I'm a big golf nerd, but you also keep it fun too with the GIFs and this and that. So if you're looking to follow Michael Kim on Twitter, it's Mike_Kim714. So give that man a follow. He is legit on Twitter and he's legit on the golf course. So Mike, thank you for filling us in on all the scoop that was happening up in Toronto, and look forward to seeing you this week. Play well.
Thanks. Always fun to chat with you guys.
Big thanks to Michael for spending some time with us while up at the RBC Canadian Open during a wild week for the game of golf. Look out for me on the Golf Channel this week, as I will be boots on the ground at Oakdale. And I'll be back here on Monday with another episode recapping the action in Canada and previewing the third major of 2023. Thanks for listening and see you then. The Smiley Show is part of the SiriusXM Sports Podcast Network. If you enjoyed this episode and want to hear more, please give a 5-star rating and leave a review. Subscribe today wherever you stream your podcast.
Leagues Cup returns to Columbus. Your reigning Leagues Cup champion Columbus Crew are hosting 3 matches at Lower.com Field. Come out and watch the crew take on teams from Liga MX, Toluca, Puebla, and Leon starting July 29th. Grab your tickets now at ColumbusCrew.com and watch the best in North America battle to keep the trophy at home in Columbus. No ties, only wins. Major League Soccer versus Liga MX. Leagues Cup returns to Columbus, Ohio. Be there.
This podcast is sponsored by IQBar. Your favorite clean, functional, delicious nutrition brand is raising the bar with a little help from Thomas Keller, Michelin star chef of the French Laundry. IQBar and Thomas Keller have teamed up to create a salted caramel chip protein bar and yuzu mango hydration mix. With toasted macadamia nuts, rich caramel flavor, and brain-boosting nutrients, this bar is like having a Michelin star meal in your pocket. Pair it with the taste bud tingling yuzu mango IQ mix hydration mix, packed with magnesium and adaptogens to improve clarity and mood. With Keller's culinary excellence and IQ Bar's commitment to great taste and clean ingredients, this limited edition collaboration is simply mwah. And the best part is that 10% of sales go directly to Chef Keller's nonprofit, Mentor, that supports aspiring young chefs. Great taste, great nutrition, great mission. Go to IQBar.com today and enter promo code KELLER20 to get 20% off all IQ Bar products plus free shipping. That's IQBAR.com, promo code KELLER20.